Hello, and welcome to this podcast on the treatment of myelofibrosis. In this episode, which includes excerpts from an educational symposium, Drs. Ruben Mesa, Andrew Kuykendall, and Sangeetha Venugopal discuss current approaches in the management of myelofibrosis and novel strategies being evaluated in clinical trials. This activity is provided by PER and supported by an educational grant from Bristol-Myers Squibb and Pharmacentia. To start things off, Dr. Venugopal reviews current treatment approaches for patients with myelofibrosis and highlights novel combinations and strategies being evaluated in clinical trials.
So this is the schematic we employ for the management of myelofibrosis. So when we see a patient with myelofibrosis, we look at what is the range of cytopenias and what is the range of whether the splenomegaly and constitutional symptoms are dominant, and then we go from there. If splenomegaly and constitutional symptoms are dominant, the first line is ruxolitinib, as you all pointed out. And in the second line, we use fedratinib. And if it's anemia with splenomegaly and constitutional symptoms, it would be momelotinib. And if the platelet count is less than 50, it would be pacritinib. So going, I don't mean this to be a data dump, but nevertheless, this is kind of all the novel therapies that are in development. So most of the drugs you all know about, the first combination is pelabresib. So this is the first drug to be combined with drugs, and this MANIFEST 2 study, this is a global blind, double-blind randomized phase 3 study. And the study population included JAK inhibitor naive patients with DIPSS intermediate 1 risk or higher, and they underwent 1-to-1 randomization. The treatment arms were pelabresib with ruxolitinib and placebo with ruxolitinib. So pelabresib was administered on day 1 to day 14. This is a 3-week cycle. And ruxolitinib was administered between day 1 to day 21 as well. So the primary endpoint of this study was spleen volume reduction 35% at week 24, and the key secondary endpoints were absolute change in TSS from baseline. So as you could see, the spleen volume change at week 24 was the pelabresib-ruxolitinib combination fared better, 65.9% as opposed to the 35.2% with the Rux monotherapy arm, and this attained statistical significance. However, with the TSS change, both of them were comparable with this 52.3% and 40.3%. And this is the MANIFEST 2 96-week follow-up, and this is a long-term follow-up of the pelabresib with ruxolitinib combination, and they did not find any new safety signals, and the efficacy endpoint was maintained, the SVR 35, and the TSS change was also maintained with the at week 96 as well. The hemoglobin response was much improved with the pelabresib-rux combination. It is 17.8% as opposed to the 11.6, and the hemoglobin levels continued to improve and approach baseline at the long-term follow-up of the MANIFEST 2 study. And myelofibrosis is inflammatory disease, and one of the key characteristics is bone marrow fibrosis. And pelabresib with ruxolitinib combination did show an improvement with bone marrow fibrosis by at least grade 1 in 52.5% of the patients as opposed to 27.5% of the patients in Rux monotherapy. And at week 96, most of the majority of the adverse events in both treatment arms were low grade and nothing struck out, and one of the other issue was the leukemia transformation with the combination arm. At the week 96, the leukemia transformation tracked with the historical data, and both arms have 5.1 and 3.7% with the Rux monotherapy. So the next one, this is selinexor. This is an XPO1 inhibitor, and this is a late-breaking abstract. This Sentry phase 3, this is a JAK inhibitor naive patient population. This is also a double-blind study with the Rux and selinexor combination as opposed to Rux monotherapy. The co-primary endpoints were classical for myelofibrosis, which is SVR 35 at week 24 and TSS 50. And this, the eligibility, the randomization was stratified by the DIPSS score and spleen volume and baseline platelet counts. So this was this, this was released by the sponsor on March 24 of 2026. The combination did achieve the SVR 35. However, the TSS change did not achieve statistical significance. With VAF reduction, the combination proved better than the monotherapy arm, and the grade 3 AEs were 70.1% with the combination arm as opposed to 50% with the monotherapy arm, and this is something to be watched out for the LBA, which is presented on June 2nd in ASCO. And the other thing that I think I read was the survival benefit, the signal of survival benefit with the combination arm in the Sentry phase 3 study. So the next exciting drug is the navtemadlin. This is a potent inhibitor of MDM2. And the graph on the right side shows the MDM2 overexpression in myelofibrosis CD34 cells. And MDM2 is a negative regulator of P53, and the MDM2 inhibitor will direct the neoplastic cells through the apoptotic pathway. And navtemadlin induces apoptosis in TP53 wild-type cells by overcoming this MDM2 dysregulation. So this is the phase 1b2 study, which enrolled patients with suboptimal response to Rux after 18 weeks of treatment. And the platelet count was should be more than 100. And again, the endpoints were classical for myelofibrosis, SVR35 at week 24, and key improvement in the TSS50. The spleen response were better with the. I think this is an older presentation, and we have a newer presentation. The spleen response was better with the navtemadlin with Rux combination compared to Rux monotherapy. And the major issue with the MDM2 inhibitors were GI side effects and thrombocytopenia, and GI side effects were better managed with prophylactic antiemetics and antidiarrheals. Imetelstat is a telomerase inhibitor, and it is currently approved in the lower-risk MDS space. And the initial phase 2 study was encouraging in myelofibrosis. It did improve the overall survival, and now the phase 3 study is evaluating overall survival as the primary endpoint with imetelstat. So the IMPROVE-MF study, this combines both imetelstat and ruxolitinib, and ruxolitinib was supposed to be given in up to 5 cycles when it is stable dose, and we add the imetelstat. No DLTs were reported at the combination was found to be safe, and no DLTs were reported at any dose level, and hematology values were stable over time. And this is an important point to note, because with imetelstat in MDS, we do see more of thrombocytopenia, but when it is used in MF, that much of thrombocytopenia is less compared to MDS. And with regards to the primary endpoints, the combination did better in terms of TSS change and with the spleen volume reduction at week 24. This is being evaluated in the phase 3 study as well. So the ROPEG interferon is evaluated in early and lower risk primary MF. Dr. Silver is a big proponent of interferon being a disease modifying drug in MPNs. And this in particular, this was presented in last ASH, and this ROPEG interferon was evaluated in early phase MF. And with the endpoints of improvement in hemoglobin, white blood cells, and platelets, and as you could see, there was a significant improvement in the hemoglobin response, white blood cells, and platelet response among all the subgroup of patients with regards to pre-PMF, overt MF, and secondary MF. And the drug was very well tolerated, and no significant toxicity was noted. So these are the select ongoing phase 3 clinical trials in myelofibrosis. Sentry, which we are going to hear about more in the LBA session. This ASCO and POIESIS is evaluating navtemadlin with ruxolitinib is an add-on after run-in compared to Rux monotherapy in JAK inhibitor naive population with either suboptimal Rux response. And impact MF, as I mentioned earlier, intermediate 2 and high-risk MF. HOPE-MF is the one that is evaluating ROPEG interferon in early-stage MF or low to intermediate risk.
Next, Drs. Mesa, Kuykendall, and Venugopal discuss how they integrate current therapies into practice for patients with myelofibrosis.
What are your indications for active treatment depending upon risk? You know, when do you consider, you know, starting a JAK inhibitor like this first case that Sangeetha provided versus perhaps an interferon?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of things I'd mention here. One, the question asked depending on risk status, and that's where I would probably fight back and say that risk status doesn't often indicate or often impact my treatment decision for patients on a day-to-day, other than deciding whether or not they're candidates for allogeneic stem cell transplant. I think if patients are low risk, intermediate 1, intermediate 2, or high risk, regardless of their risk status, if they're coming in with constitutional symptoms and splenomegaly, then usually going down the JAK inhibitor route. If they're coming in with cytopenias and the absence of those, then typically going down some sort of anemia-directed route. Now, obviously, patients who have anemia are not going to fall into the low and intermediate 1 risk groups because that's often going to push them into the higher risk groups. Then the question you come back to is, what about interferons? And I think that's a difficult question. I don't think we exactly know the optimal place or the significance of the role of interferons in, you know, low to intermediate 1 risk disease. I think we certainly isolate it to that area because those are the patients that don't have typically massive splenomegaly. They don't have severe cytopenia, so that might be the area where we can intervene earlier. Maybe we call that pre-fibrotic myelofibrosis as well, because once there's a good amount of scar tissue, I think interferons can be quite difficult. But I think that my typical paradigm is if we're talking about spleen and symptoms, going down the JAK inhibitor route regardless of what the risk status is. I think intermediate to high risk, going towards transplant and then considering the spleen and symptoms aspect. And then in the earlier, like in the lower risk category of patients, oftentimes if there's not a JAK inhibitor based therapy or an anemia directed therapy, then I'm thinking, okay, what about their, you know, thrombotic risk reduction, right? And that's where interferons could come into play as well. So if they're a younger patient, we're worried about disease progression, we're trying to mitigate the thrombotic risk, then interferons certainly have a role there. And then I tend to favor that in JAK2 mutated disease because I think the data is maybe a little bit stronger in potentially impacting that, although, you know, recent data suggests there may be an impact on CALR as well.
Very helpful. You know, I think as we put together the HOPE-PMF study, again, I think it very much matches with what you had said, where interferon, and particularly for those individuals who we have not historically considered candidates yet for the JAK inhibitors, you know, can we slow down that process? Again, that phenotype does overlap a bit with earlier ET in particular, you know, and can you really alter that trajectory? Whereas kind of more advanced disease, you know, at least as monotherapy, maybe more of a challenge, you know, although in data from Jean-Jacques Kilajan from France, they certainly did a phase 2 study of interferon and a JAK inhibitor that was active, but that's obviously a slightly different approach, but one that still may need to be explored. Now, Sangeetha, the next question is an interesting one because, you know, all three of us, you know, lean more as kind of medical hematologists as opposed to transplanters, where, again, we're trying to discover new therapies. But the transplant question is a key one. You know, where do you think that stands in 2026? You know, which patients, you know, are you sending for evaluation at Sylvester to meet the transplanters in this day and age?
So at diagnosis, I send all my patients to transplanters. So it's not necessarily it is intermediate risk or high risk. So at diagnosis, I send all my patients. And even with some of these intermediate patients, they are very cytopenic. And they don't really, if they don't respond to JAK inhibitors, and those are those candidates, those patients are better candidates for transplant.
And Andrew and I have shared a few patients because I think the age of transplant differs from center to center. And one of my patients who was not eligible for transplant at my center was transplanted in Andrew's place. So
you get more eligible the more north you go in Florida. If you make it to Tallahassee, then
yeah. So I guess it's at diagnosis, all my patients see the transplant physician. And it's also one of the thing is because we are in Miami and there are more of Latinx population there and the donor availability does impact transplants. So I really don't want to wait until the last moment. And if I send them earlier, then when the time comes, it's probably easier to find a match rather than later.
I see. And perhaps for both of your centers, you know, and I strongly agree, you know, I always send folks so that they meet the transplanters and kind of have the discussion, realizing still the minority kind of go through with the transplant. And that can be for a range of reasons, their risk, you know, their own choice, which sometimes is a big factor, but also who the transplant team really feels strongly about, you know, strongly encouraging versus saying, you know, we could do a transplant, but obviously there's kind of ranges of how strongly we encourage folks. Who are your centers kind of, you know, what are the features that really tend to push them over the line and say, boy, we really think that you should do this? You know, it's always a choice. But again, like any of us having conversations with patients, you know, be like, yeah, I guess you could do a transplant versus if you were my sister, I would tell you to do a transplant. You know, there clearly are different ways of encouragement.
I would say that we've gotten to the point now, we have a good relationship with the transplanters. I think, you know, at our center, you know, it's an ongoing discussion, right? I often tell patients, like, this is like a three-way decision and everyone has veto power. So between, like, the transplanter, the medical oncologist, and the patient slash family, right, like, everyone has to agree that we're going to do this. And if anyone says no, then it's probably not going to happen. Now, the ones that we feel the most comfortable with, like, hey, this one should go to transplant, are the folks that have high-risk aspects of the disease that we don't have therapies that help with, right? So transfusion dependency, I think, is the big one. Like, we are starting to develop transfusion or starting to develop therapies that might be able to help with that transfusion dependency, but historically we haven't had those, right? So if you have a young patient who's fit, who has myelofibrosis, bad mutations, they're transfusion dependent, like, that's someone that we want to transplant relatively quickly. The newly diagnosed patient who's like higher risk, who has symptoms and splenomegaly, that's someone that you know, we're not necessarily going to transplant them immediately because we'd like to see how they respond to JAK inhibition. And sometimes they respond remarkably well, and then you get in this tough decision where the time they're the best candidates for transplant is the time they feel like they don't need it anymore. But I think the other thing that, you know, you kind of alluded to earlier is that you have to look at the patient, the clinical aspects, and the genetics. When you see multiple high-risk mutations in a patient, you know, that's someone you realize, like, you know, as much as we can do, like, this is probably going to dictate how their disease acts in the long term. Timing can be difficult there, but if they're already showing the clinical features of anemia, thrombocytopenia, plus high-risk mutations, then I think that's someone that you take to transplant very quickly.
You know, you said several key things there, but one that particularly resonates that I've shared with folks is that the time you feel that by the time you feel you need a transplant, it's probably too late. You know, its value as a salvage therapy is not great. If patient's performance status is down, they've already progressed, you know, you're fighting blasts. I mean, we can do it, but the outcomes are clearly worse. You know, so for the young patient with higher risk features, again, who starts on a JAK inhibitor, we're trying to find the donor, there's always this delay. You know, I always really couch it for them in the beginning. I'm like, your disease has a high risk of progressing and potentially being fatal. We're going to start you on this medicine. You're going to feel better, you know, and that's great. And that's going to make hopefully the success of the transplant greater. But that doesn't mean that it diminishes really the need. It kind of gives us the window to really try to have a better outcome. So I think it's always key because, again, I've had a bunch of folks who've said, boy, I feel better now. I really don't want to do this. They don't transplant, but then they eventually do progress, and then they succumb, you know, clearly much earlier than any of us would want. Sangeeta, any alternative thoughts in terms of the approach at Sylvester?
I would agree with all that Andrew said. And the other one I would, from my standpoint, that I find difficult is when patients are thrombocytopenic and I really cannot get their platelets up, and they're, and that's one of the reasons that I recommend transplant for those patients.
Very good.
The other one will be like if I'm cycling through JAK inhibitors for cytopenias, then those patients will be on the top of my list.
Dr. Venugopal reviews recent data and investigational approaches for the management of myelofibrosis-related anemia.
This led to the phase 3 independent study. This is the key eligibility criteria was MPN-associated MF, and RBC transfusion was either between 4 to 12, and this was the stratification was based on baseline RBC burden and DIP score. Luspatercept was given in the standard dose with and the primary endpoint was the transfusion independence. So this was the sponsor released the data on July 18th of 2025. We are awaiting for the primary analysis, which is going to be presented in EHA. The primary endpoint was the rate of RBC transfusion independence over 12 weeks. This was not met. We don't have the full data set yet, so we are waiting for the final read of this data in EHA 2026. Still, there is real-world data for luspatercept in MF-associated anemia. In this real-world study, patients with MF who required RBC transfusion who were treated with luspatercept did achieve clinically meaningful benefits, including 12 and 16-week red blood cell transfusion and greater than 50% of RBC transfusion burden. This study we are excited about because this is Odyssey trial, which combines both momelotinib and luspatercept, because momelotinib does act on the ACVR1 inhibition and it is approved in the MF and anemia space. And luspatercept is an activin binding trap. And this is explored in two cohorts, and this early results were presented in last ASH, and it did so show preliminary efficacy in terms of transfusion burden. And 36% of the patients did show increased hemoglobin compared to the baseline. And elritercept is the second generation activin receptor binding trap, and this is a cousin of sotatercept, which is currently approved in pulmonary fibrosis. This was presented in ASH 2024 by Dr. Harrison. The patient, excuse me. Was MF-associated anemia, and the baseline platelet count was greater than 25, and it was low transfusion burden and high transfusion burden. You could see that there was early efficacy seen in both the monotherapy and the on the Rux combination arms. And this is being evaluated in MDS as well. This is going to phase 3. And the other drug that I am excited is this anti-hemojuvelin monoclonal antibody, and this has really good responses in patients who are anemic and who are on concomitant JAK inhibitor therapy. And about 54% of the population did show a good response with this drug. This drug is given as an injection every 4 weeks.
The panelists discussed their approach to treating anemia in patients with myelofibrosis.
So let's get into just a little bit about the anemia issue kind of more broadly. So, you know, we talk about kind of transfusion dependence. You know, Andrew, kind of what percentage of your patients would you say, you know, what do you really think is a threshold for kind of transfusion dependent or not? You know, where are you transfusing these days? You know, what does that look like in your practice?
Yeah, I mean, so probably the proportion of patients that are transfusion dependent is probably around 20%, 25%, something to that degree. But it's hard to define that, right? Because it increases the longer. So if you have a patient population that you've been following for a long time, then you know that the prevalence of transfusion dependency will likely go up, as it's part of the natural history of the disease. You know, I think when you transfuse patients is very much dependent upon kind of the severity of their anemia, their symptoms, their ability to tolerate the anemia. You know, we have patients that sit at 7.5 to 8, do not want transfusions, feel well, we don't transfuse them. They have others that if they get to 8.5, right, they get profoundly symptomatic and we transfuse them. And so that is a bit individualized. And I think that makes studying it and doing it within the context of clinical trials very challenging because, you know, you don't want to enter in bias to this and you have to have, you know, objective definitions of what transfusion, you know, independence is and what transfusion dependence is. And so I think the DISC study and the trial is actually really nicely designed to kind of separate people into three different cohorts of anemia since they shouldn't all be lumped together. you know, and to your point about, you know, what's causing this, is it the drug or the disease? You know, it's always both, right? I mean, I think especially when you're talking about drugs that cause anemia, but certainly it could be more one than the other, too. But we give ruxolitinib to polycythemia vera patients, and they don't get anemic, right? They drop their counts, and they stay in a reasonable zone on you know, 10 milligrams, usually twice daily. So the fact that myelofibrosis patients start at 11 or 10, and then they drop to 8 or 7, right? That's from the drug, but at the same time, like, their disease is also causing some of that anemia as well.
So luspatercept is, you know, is somewhat unique in that it's both an agent that we're evaluating, but it's also an agent that we're using every day, you know, for our patients with low-risk MDS, you know, and largely, you know, the practices clearly overlap. You know, MPN physicians usually are seeing MDS patients or being cared for by the same nurses, same infusion unit, so there's that level of comfort. So Sangeeta, you know, where are you using any off-label luspatercept kind of at the current time, you know, in MF patients, as well as kind of what is the practice in South Florida? You know, I could certainly say, I certainly see patients that are receiving a kind of off-label based on, again, the kind of the combination of the phase 2 data with MF, comfort from the phase 3 data, comfort with using the medicine. You know, what does that look like in your practice?
So I rarely see, because we have studies for anemia-directed therapy, so I don't use upfront luspatercept, but I have used erythropoietins, recombinant erythropoietin with Rux, and I could get some responses with the anemia. But I rarely see luspatercept used off-label outside with the referrals that comes to me.
Andrew, how about yourself?
Yeah, I mean, I agree that in patients that are trial candidates, we've often had things to offer. You know, we're managing a lot of folks that are out in the community, though, and are not able to go on trials. And, you know, it's challenging because, you know, we just don't have the same biomarker for response like we do with MDS, where we look at these SF3B1 mutations and those ring sideroblast patients do quite well. And, you know, in myelofibrosis, SF3B1 mutations are much more rare. That being said, we do have, I mean, that's the part where I feel, you know, more justified in using it, is you have someone who's dealing with anemia, who's on Rux, who has an underlying splicing or SF3B1 mutation, you know, that we could try. The nice thing about luspatercept is you do get a signal if it's working within a month or two. So if it is someone who's looking for a therapy to boost the anemia, reduce their transfusion risk, you know, maybe their baseline EPO's, you know, above 125, or they've already been on ESAs, you know, then it's certainly reasonable to give it a shot, and you'll get a quick answer within the first couple months of whether it's having benefit.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. For more information on this topic, click on the link in the podcast description.